Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it is my great pleasure to introduce you to the festival's 2014 season, Around Dvorak. Music at Menlo's 2014 season explores dual facets of the unfolding of Western music throughout the classical and romantic eras and into the 20th century. Catalyzed by a lineage of composers from Haydn and Mozart, through Schubert and Brahms, to Schoenberg, Webern, and Berg a generation later, Vienna emerged as the epicenter of a dynamic musical tradition that remains central to the canon today. Meanwhile, starting in the latter half of the 19th century, the folk traditions of Hungary, Romania, and the Czech lands permeated Western classical music, as composers like Bedřich Smetana, Lajos Janáček, Béla Bartók, and Zoltán Kodály awakened to the richness of their own musical heritage and sought to cultivate a distinct musical voice. At the center of this dialectic was Antonín Dvořák, the self-described simple Czech musicant who likewise possessed the romantic ferocity of his mentor, Johannes Brahms. No other composer so fluently integrated the dual traditions of Western classicism and Central European folk music, developing a distinct musical language whose influence would be felt as far as the United States. This season, Music at Menlo offers 8 colorful concert programs that revolve around Dvorak, taking listeners on a thrilling journey between Vienna, Prague, and other fascinating musical destinations along the way. Audio notes are designed to enhance your enjoyment and deepen your appreciation of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by Artistic Co-Director Wu Han, Audio Notes author and producer Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists to offer historical and cultural context and a variety of perspectives on this summer's concert programs. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the festival.
Complementing the irresistible influence of his Czech musical heritage, Dvořák likewise aspired to write music of broader, more universal appeal. The Viennese classical tradition that Dvořák drew upon, encompassing the foundation laid by Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, and Schubert, is further explored in the summer's second concert program. Viennese Roots begins with music by the father of the classical style, Joseph Haydn, whose contributions to the piano trio literature elevated the genre from light salon music to chamber music of the highest sophistication. Franz Schubert, the first composer of the Viennese canon native to that city, inherited the tradition cultivated by Haydn and ushered it into the 19th century for the emergence of the Romantic generation. Dvorak's bass quintet further dwells on the flowering of this new aesthetic in deeply felt strengths.
The artistic life of Joseph Haydn embodies the breadth of the Viennese classical era. He was born in 1732, near the end of the Baroque period. J.S. Bach would live another 18 years until 1750, and George Friedrich Handel until 1759. And over the course of Haydn's life, indeed largely by his own hand, what has since become known as the classical style would grow to maturity. By the time of Haydn's death in 1809, his student Ludwig van Beethoven was boldly extending the classical idiom with his own brand of fiery individualism. And within 5 years, the precocious Viennese teenager Franz Schubert would pen his first significant works. Haydn's excellence in every prevalent musical genre of the day rendered him the most celebrated composer of his generation. And his seminal role in cultivating the signature innovations of that period have earned him historical standing as the father of the classical style. Noting his foundational contributions to the symphony and the string quartet genres, two of Western music's quintessential media since the 18th century. Musicologist James Webster writes that, quote, "No other composer approaches Haydn's combination of productivity, quality, and historical importance in these genres. In the 20th century, he was understood primarily as an absolute musician, but earnestness, depth of feeling, and referential tendencies are equally important to his art." End quote. Haydn's importance to the piano trio genre was just as transformative as his role in advancing the symphony and the string quartet. First of all, he wrote a lot of them, expanding the trio literature by at least 45 pieces. And over his career, he elevated what had once been regarded as light salon music to real chamber music, a sophisticated dialogue between three equal partners. Haydn's Piano Trio No. 27 in C major, even though it was composed relatively late in his career, in 1797, in the context of Haydn's complete trio output, it seems a kind of anachronism. The piano plays a dominant role. In fact, it was published, as had long been the convention, as a sonata for piano accompanied by violin and cello. And it's true, we hear right away the piano is front and center, spinning forth the eloquent opening theme, gently highlighted by the violin and cello. But it would be a mistake to dismiss this trio's straightforwardness as regressive. That seeming simplicity, the sonata for piano accompanied by violin and cello tag, is deceptive. You see, Haydn, innovative genius that he was a restless tinkerer. If you take his symphonies, for example, all 104 of them, we hear him experimenting radically with form in his middle symphonies. By the time we get to his final and most celebrated symphonies, he's perfected his approach to form and is on to something else. The symphonies at the end of Haydn's career all essentially follow the same blueprint, but their approach to orchestration, to instrumental color, is completely new. And so it is with the piano trios. By 1797, Haydn's already liberated the violin and cello from simple accompaniment roles. It's like he doesn't have to prove it anymore. Now he's playing with more refined elements, things like harmony and instrumental texture. Let's take, for example, the beginning of the first movement's development section. It begins with this weird, disorienting series of appoggiaturas, little melodic ornaments that lean into the main note. As it goes on for a few measures, we have this sense that the music's gotten lost, the harmony has lost its way, and making things more disorienting is Haydn's use of register. Both hands of the piano are jumping around all over the keyboard, and the violin and cello can't figure out what register to play in either. And then, with all three instruments now thoroughly confused, it's as if they hold hands, take a deep breath, and plunge in together. But it's like they guess wrong and find themselves in a completely foreign key, A flat major, which is quite remote from the home key. The piece is in C major. So we might expect the development to start like this, in the dominant key of G major. But instead, Haydn gives us this. That's just one example of Haydn's inventiveness, even in such a seemingly innocuous work as this quote-unquote, sonata for piano accompanied by violin and cello. The second movement is a tender andante, full of flowing lyricism. And the trio ends with a buoyant presto finale, featuring, as a matter of fact, quite involved conversational writing between the three instruments, ultimately giving lie to Haydn's publisher's modest claim.
Following Haydn, the father of the Viennese classical style, the program continues with Franz Schubert, Dvorak's favorite composer and most important influence from early on in his career.
Franz Schubert, one of Western music history's greatest geniuses, was born in Vienna in 1797, the only composer of the Viennese canon native to that musical capital. His was a Vienna revolutionized by Beethoven's powerful symphonies, but likewise under the spell of Rossini's delectable operas and the thrilling virtuosity of Niccolò Paganini. In this environment, and supported by a devoted coterie of friends and patrons, Schubert quietly produced an astounding body of work. The American composer John Harbison has credited Schubert with writing, quote, the best piece in every genre he really tackled, end quote. These included, most notably, more than 600 Lieder, songs for voice and piano, as well as an extensive catalog of piano music, chamber music, and symphonies. In all of these, Schubert demonstrated a sublime instinct for melody and an expressive depth that have endeared his music to listeners for nearly two centuries. Schubert's musical life was as ephemeral as it was remarkable. He took gravely ill in 1823, contracting what almost certainly was syphilis, and died 5 years later at the age of 31. But despite his great physical suffering and psychic anguish at the end of his life, Schubert remained incredibly prolific. In the final year of his life, Schubert completed the two piano trios, the Ninth Symphony, appropriately known as The Great, the Cello Quintet, and the last three piano sonatas, among numerous other keyboard, vocal, and orchestral works. All told, an imposing set of masterpieces, miraculously concentrated within a deeply trying 12 months, and unequaled by many composers over entire lifetimes. What follows on the summer's second concert program are two short but superb works dating from Schubert's final years. The first, the Impromptu in A-flat major for solo piano, composed in 1827, is the last of a set of four self-contained miniatures, a genre of solo piano music that was especially popular in the 1820s. Music scholar Robert Winter has written, quote, the compositional freedom afforded by this new genre stimulated some of Schubert's most original creations, end quote. The Impromptu starts off with cascading 16th note arpeggios, which remain in place as the signature gesture of the piece. But underneath these fleet figurations, a broad melody emerges in the left hand of the piano. Elegant combination of inspired melody and pianistic virtuosity, as well as its enigmatic expressivity, This A-flat impromptu offers a quintessential snapshot of Schubert's musical identity. Likewise, the Rondo Brillant in B minor for violin and piano, composed in 1826. Like its better-known sibling, the much-beloved C major fantasy for violin and piano, composed the following year, the Rondo Brillant was intended for the young Bohemian virtuoso, Josef Slavik. Also like the C major fantasy, the Rondo Brillant offers all the trappings of a virtuoso showpiece, perhaps with a Viennese audience in mind that was enthralled with Paganini's caprices. But beneath its explosive virtuosity, the Rondo contains finely wrought music of piercing expressive depth. The work begins with a stately introduction, marked by double dotted chords in the piano and upward flourishes in the violin. It's a striking curtain raiser, but more than that, a close listen reveals Schubert's thoughtful craftsmanship right from the outset. Notice how Schubert doesn't just throw that violin flourish onto the page, which, you know, would have sounded great in its own right, but instead, the violin raises up to the top of the staff, then stresses the last two notes, B and C sharp. After the lyrical introduction runs its course, it ends, suspensefully, on those same two pitches. It turns out that B and C sharp are centrally important to the main body of the piece. It's the launching pad for the Rondo's refrain. And in that opening run, behind its artifice of virtuosic showmanship, Schubert is actually signaling to the listener the structural importance of that simple motive to the overall form of the piece. That tiny gesture turns out to be the glue that holds together the Rondo's refrain and series of episodes. Of course, appreciating the music's tight construction isn't meant to miss the forest for the trees. And certainly, a big part of the pleasure of this rondo is its melodic brilliance and sheer display of virtuosity. Rondo Brillant, taken together with the impromptu that we hear before it on this program, illustrates an essential quality of Schubert's genius. And it's a quality that has particularly captivated composers for generations, from Schumann, Brahms, and Dvorak to the composers of our time. This music, whether on account of its melodic immediacy, its virtuosic flair, or some other straightforward quality, is unfailingly irresistible. But behind that beguiling immediacy is such emotional complexity as we find in the A-flat impromptu, and such subtle yet impeccable craftsmanship as in the Rondo Brillant, that what might seem on first listen to be nothing more or less than a virtuoso showpiece, in fact belongs in the realm of Western music's greatest accomplishments. Many of the most beloved qualities of Schubert's music, its melodic beauty, its winsome sincerity, we find much of that in the final piece on Concert Program 2 as well, the string quintet in G major, opus 77 of Antonín Dvořák. The G major quintet is the second of three string quintets that Dvořák composed, but in fact, it's unique in Dvořák's oeuvre. His first and third quintets are scored for the conventional quintet ensemble of string quartet with second viola. But the opus 77 quintet calls for string quartet and double bass. Naturally, the quintet's unconventional scoring lends it a particular sonority.
The sound of the piece is a very interesting choice by Dvořák, adding a bass to the regular string quartet.
Cellist Dmitry Atapin.
In a way, this does two things. It provides a very sturdy and very grounded bass and expands the whole range of the ensemble pretty much an octave lower, while liberating the cello to join the violin and the viola in the upper register. The cello, as Dvořák probably knew, can be very projecting on the A string. And so once the cello moves into that range, it can compete much more as an equal partner with the other higher strings. And it creates a denser texture. And it's very interesting what Dvořák does contrapuntally with this.
The bass quintet marks an important point in Dvořák's early career. At 33 years old, he had recently come to the attention of Johannes Brahms, who had served on the panel of judges awarding Dvořák the Austrian State Stipendium, an important new cultural award. Brahms was particularly taken by the distinct Czech elements of Dvořák's music, and likewise took up the young composer's cause, writing to his publisher, Fritz Simrock, quote, "As for the State Stipendium, I have enjoyed work sent in by Antonín Dvořák of Prague. This year he has sent works that seem to me very pretty. Play them through and you will like them as much as I do. Dvořák has written all manner of things, operas in Czech, symphonies, quartets, piano pieces. In any case, he is a very talented man. Moreover, he is poor. I ask you to think about it." End quote. With Brahms's endorsement, Simrock began publishing Dvořák's music, essentially launching his international career. In addition to marking an important time for Dvořák professionally, the bass quintet also represents a watershed moment for the composer artistically. It's with this work that Dvořák casts off his youthful fascination with the iconoclastic music of Richard Wagner, instead turning wholeheartedly to the classical models of Mozart and Schubert. With these Viennese roots firmly planted, while likewise continuing to nurture the Czech folk element of his language, Dvořák finds his voice as a composer with the Opus 77 quintet.
The bass quintet is an interesting work because even though it bears a kind of a late opus number of 77, actually it's a very youthful piece, a very young piece. I believe it was written at the beginning of Dvořák's career in 1875. And I actually find it extremely folky. Every movement has these dance qualities. You know, the first is very joyful, and you know it has this running triplets versus 16th rhythms, these crossover rhythms that are so exciting.
The quintet begins with a slow, serene introduction, like the sun coming up on an idyllic scene. The scene suddenly comes to life. And with the first proper statement of the theme, Dvořák capitalizes right away on the expanded sonority of his ensemble. He sets the melody in the tenor register of the cello, supported by the double bass. a jovial new musical idea appears, not in the dominant key of D major, as would be expected, but in F major, a key traditionally associated with pastoral themes. As the music nears the end of the exposition, the cello continues to relish its liberated melodic role, trading soaring, singing lines with the first violin. And the exposition comes to a close with the full force of the ensemble en masse, the bass likewise joining in and augmenting the dance-like rhythm. In the ensuing development section, Dvorak further explores the textural possibilities afforded by the ensemble. The addition of the double bass is especially appreciable in the development's stormier moments, as rumbling thunderclouds gather above the music's heretofore idyllic setting. But the clouds part, clearing the way for a sunny return to G major. As with the first movement, a classical sonata form movement, rife with fetching melodies and rich harmonies evocative of Bohemian folk music, the second movement combines that folk element with the trappings of Viennese classicism. The movement is cast in the scherzo mold of Beethoven and Schubert, which Dvorak uses as a vehicle for a vigorous Bohemian folk dance. The central trio section, betraying perhaps Dvorak's penchant for the music of Schubert, is emotionally enigmatic. Beneath a flowing melody in the violin, the lower strings vacillate between major and minor. The music has a sense of smiling through tears that we often associate with Schubert, but, of course, inflected with Dvorak's singularly Bohemian accent.
Well, I always find Dvorak an extremely attractive composer. I find it fascinating his folkish language. You know, he very much talks to the Eastern European folklore and the natural melodiousness of his music. I also find him as a romantic composer. He's a little bit interesting because I always find that he has this amazing gift for serene melancholy in his slow movements. He has this beautiful lyrical gift. It does not go into this deep, heart-wrenching sadness or sorrow, but instead appeals to this more romantic, melancholic, nostalgic aspect that is so unique to him.
Dvorak probes the subtle poignancy of the second movement's trio section more deeply in the slow third movement.
The third is very, very lush and very intense. It's not a true adagio, as you might expect. I think it's actually quite a driving slow movement, and it requires a lot of intensity, which is so appropriate for this ensemble because it's all strings, and the strings are... Dvorak really knows how to bring out these singing qualities and emotional qualities from string instruments. Every string instrument gets a special moment, I think, with Dvorak. And as a cellist, of course, I can think of many beautiful cello solos that Dvorak gives us. And he really is very much in tune with the nature of every instrument. For example, he does use the cello on the A string, which makes it project more and more singing quality. He often uses the viola on the lower strings, where it provides that kind of unique viola sound. And he really knows how to use instruments that even play in the same range, but bringing out the unique qualities about them. Finally, the fourth movement is a big party with dancing and propelling rhythms.
After asserting different facets of his compositional voice in the previous three movements, his lyrical melodic sense, his subtle harmonic sensitivity, and master of instrumental timbre, Dvorak rounds off the bass quintet with an unapologetically joyful finale, rife with one inspired tune after another. Owing once again in no small part to the double bass, the finale possesses an expansive sonority, pegging Dvorak as a manifest romantic in the tradition of Schubert and Brahms. But this final movement likewise reaffirms that Dvorak's brand of romanticism is a deeply personal one, marked by that bohemian accent that is unmistakably Dvorak.
I think that he was definitely very much touched by Brahms in his career. You know, Brahms was a big supporter of Dvorak, as we know. And I think there is some trend, as he was maturing as a composer, to emulate Brahms' style a little bit and maybe appeal to a wider audience. But then the introduction of the folkish element creates this magical marriage of serious sophistication with immediacy and spontaneity that is so proper of the folkish dance qualities. Thank you.
Audio Notes are authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Patrick Castillo, and Wu Han. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts on this disc appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Mozart's Serenata Notturna was performed by A Far Cry and produced by Jesse Lewis and Roger Tapping. Dvorak's String Quartet in E-flat Major Opus 51 and Martinu's Three Madrigals are performed by the Emerson String Quartet and appear courtesy of Deutsche Grammophon. Dvorak's String Sextet in A Major Opus 48, performed by violinist Joseph Silverstein and Annika Vafian, violists Mark Holloway and Paul Neubauer, and cellists Andreas Brantelied and Fred Sherry, and Bartok's Divertimento for Strings, performed by Ida Kavafian, Sean Lee, Kristen Lee, Choliang Lin, Yura Lee, Arno Sussman, Areta Jula, Nicola Dautricor, Aaron Boyd, Stephen Tenenbaum, Richard O'Neill, Pierre Lapointe, Nicholas Kanalakis, Mihai Marika, Dane Johansson, and Kurt Moroki appear courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Haydn's String Quartet in D Minor, Opus 76, No. 2, performed by the Danish String Quartet, and Schubert's Rondo in A Major for Violin and Strings, performed by violinist Sean Lee with Georgia Flizanis, Benjamin Bielman, Richard O'Neill, and David Finkel, appear courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. Haydn's Piano Trio No. 27 in C Major is performed by the Mendelssohn Piano Trio and appears courtesy of Centaur Records. Schubert's Impromptu in A-flat Major, performed by Nikolai Demidenko, and Rondo Brillant, performed by violinist Alina Ibrahimova and pianist Cedric Tabergian, and Dvorak's String Quintet in G Major, Opus 77, performed by the Kuhl Quartet and Peter Bukowski, appear courtesy of Hyperion Records. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Led.